We often talk about blue and red states, but what about blue and red counties? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. The dust has settled after the election, giving us the ability to analyze voting patterns in Iowa. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa took a look at some of Iowa's most Democratic and Republican counties. He's here to discuss what might influence those voting patterns. Plus, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Bruce Nesmith from Coe College are here to discuss the week in politics. Join our conversation right after this news. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We've heard about red and blue states, and Iowa was in the blue column in the most recent presidential election. But when you look a little more closely, the picture is more complicated. It's politics day, and we're going to be talking about some of Iowa's reddest and bluest counties. Our guests today are Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. He's in our Cedar Falls studio. Chris, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College is on the phone. Wayne, good to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
And Bruce Nesmith of Coe College in Cedar Rapids. He's in our Iowa City studio. Bruce, thanks for being here.
Good afternoon, Clay.
And now, Chris Larimer at the University of Northern Iowa, we ask you to do some number crunching on a couple counties. Sioux County up in northwestern Iowa, it should be said this is north of Sioux City. Sioux City isn't in this county. Right. It is home to Orange City, where Northwestern College is located, a Christian liberal arts school. It's also headquarters of the dining destination Pizza Ranch. It's a very red county, Sioux County. We also had you look at Johnson County, of course, home to Iowa City and the University of Iowa, a county that often votes Democratic. Chris, what did your research tell you about these counties in particular?
Well, yeah, you're right. These are two counties we typically think of as being very different in terms of how they vote. Sioux County in northwestern Iowa, we always think of as being a very Republican county, and Johnson County, as you said, with Iowa City, the University of Iowa, as being a very Democratic county. And so I went back through from 2000 through 2012 and just looked at every election every 2 years, both federal and statewide elections, and just compiled, you know, the percent two-party vote going to the Republican candidate. So this is the number of votes out of both Democrats and Republicans that went to the Republican candidate, and then the party ID over the last 12 years. And starting with Sioux County, if you look at it, the two-party vote for the Republican candidate is pretty consistently above 80%. That is, the Republican candidate tends to get over 80% of the vote when you combine the votes for Democrat and Republican candidates. The party ID in Sioux County is reliably above 70% Republican. And so if you combine those two numbers, what you're really looking for is any sort of deviation from that 70% of the folks who identify with the Republican Party. So, for example, in 2012, you know, the district with Steve King and Christy Vilsack, the congressional race out there, was seen as more competitive for Steve King than in previous races. And what we found is that that deviation from the percent party ID, so the deviation from the 70% of the folks in Sioux County who identify as Republican, was actually down to 10%. In other words, Christy Vilsack was able to get more votes than most Democratic candidates do in Sioux County. And similarly, in 2002, the 2002 U.S. Senate race, you saw Tom Harkin get considerably more votes than Democratic candidates typically do in Sioux County, where that deviation was down to about 9 percentage points. And in 2008 and 2012, in the race for the presidency, that deviation again got down to about 10 percentage points. In other words, the Democratic candidates were getting closer to 30% of the vote in Sioux County than in what they had in the past. And so that's a nice measure of what's going on in Sioux County. But again, this is a very consistent Republican county. For the most part, Republican candidates are going to get anywhere from 80 to 90% of the two-party vote. If you look at Johnson County, you know, similar numbers going back from 2000 through 2012, and again looking at the two-party vote for the Republican candidate and looking at party ID in the county, what you see is that it's a bit more mixed. Certainly Johnson County is certainly more Democratic than Sioux County and pretty reliably Democratic overall, but The percent GOP in this case is about 20%. So folks in the county on average are about the number of people there are about 20% Republican. What's unique about Johnson County is you've had a few races where Republicans have actually done quite well. So if you look at the 2000, 2002, and 2004 races for the U.S. House covering that district, you see Jim Leach doing quite well in Johnson County and, in fact, winning that county if you look at the two-party vote. Similarly, you know, Chuck Grassley has done quite well in Johnson County. Chuck Grassley does well everywhere in Iowa, but he still does quite well in what's considered traditionally to be a Democratic county, getting over 54% of the vote in 2004 and 48% of the vote in 2010, and that was his race with Roxanne Conlin. You actually saw Roxanne Conlin cut that advantage a little bit and cut it less to 50%. And so again – oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say you've done all this research. You've spent all this time with these two counties. Stepping back, what are the implications, would you say?
Well, I think the implications are that if you look at Sioux County, this is a Republican county. It's a very reliable county. If you're a strategist there, you can pretty much count on the fact that a Republican candidate is going to get close to 85 to 90% of the vote there. What you would look at is you look at that deviation percent. So if you can cut that down to 10%, that's a case where you have a strong Democratic challenger. But for the most part, a Democrat is not going to do well in Sioux County. In Johnson County, it's just the opposite. If you can have a strong Republican candidate, and actually a strong Republican candidate can do much better in Johnson County than a strong Democratic candidate can do in Sioux County.
And now I'd also like to ask Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Bruce Nesmith of Coe College to jump in when you have thoughts as well. I want to talk a little bit about there's this identity crisis that people keep bringing up that the Republicans seem to be having right now. But it doesn't seem to be a problem in Sioux County, does it?
This is Wayne Moyer. I think it doesn't. What strikes me, though, from this data, and I think one of the reasons that Iowa is a swing state, is that we have these very Democratic counties and we have these very Republican counties, and there's a lot of stability in the voting in both types of county. And fortunately, the state is pretty even, I suspect. These are two extreme examples. But my guess is there's not a lot of variation in very many of the counties in any given election, and that the overall mix is very close. And that's what makes Iowa a really interesting state in presidential elections.
Bruce, would you like to weigh in here?
Sure. If you listen to some of the people in the Republican Party as they think back on the last election, you're getting kind of two themes. One is we didn't press our core beliefs strongly enough, and the other would be that certain groups, in large measure, particularly Latinos, which is a fast-growing demographic in the United States, were turned off by Republican rhetoric, particularly on immigration. And if you look at Sioux County, they would be an example of a group that would be responding to the core convictions of the Republican Party, and they seem to have responded pretty well. The vote totals, well, I'm not going to sit here and add them in my head, but this seems like the overall vote totals are pretty similar or better than they were in previous presidential elections. The people that Republicans feel like they need to get in order to sustain a national majority are not, by and large, in Sioux County.
You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're talking about the way that the counties, two counties in particular, Sioux County and Johnson County, one very much in the red column in Sioux County, and Johnson very much in the blue. Bruce, first of all, I'd like to ask you, the listener, do these numbers surprise you? Is there something about Iowa that makes these political swings possible? Call us at 866-780-9100. Join our conversation. We're also on Facebook, Iowa Public Radio, where you can tweet us at IPR Talk or Clayton Masters. Bruce brought up the theory talking about immigration. And there's this theory out there that I heard from a lot of Democrats were saying it to me as I was covering the presidential election, that a time's going to come when Texas might become more Democratic or at least a swing state because of the immigration population there. Sioux County, there's a pork meat packing plant there, which is a magnet for immigrant labor. Could this be a concern for the same concern that Republicans might have about Texas being a problem? What would you say to that theory, Chris?
Well, you know, it's probably a little bit too early to tell. Certainly, if you look at just some of the numbers that we've compiled so far, you're not seeing a lot of changes in the raw numbers as far as the number of people identifying as Democrats or the number of people identifying as Republicans or those identifying as no party. In other words, you're not seeing a lot of change in the population of Sioux County. So unless those party ID numbers start to move a little bit, mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you're going to see a lot of change there. Because if you look, you know, Catherine Perkins did some nice work as far as just looking at the demographic differences between Sioux County and Johnson County. Sioux County is, you know, compared to Johnson County, is considerably older. You have a lower poverty rate and on average less educated. And so, you know, those tend to be demographics that match up with the Republican Party. So I'm not sure we're quite to the point where we can say Sioux County is on the path that Texas might be on.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because you mentioned some of the demographic research that our executive producer of talk shows, Catherine Perkins, did. Hispanic demographics in Sioux County, 9.2%. Mm-hmm. That's compared to in Johnson County, 4.9%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. I think, you know, that may change the voting characteristics over time. But right now, going back to something that Wayne said, in both counties, you see remarkable stability in terms of who's casting a vote for which candidate. I mean, it's amazing when you think about all the elections from 2000 through 2012. You had the 2000 Bush versus Gore election. You had, you know, the 2004 election with Kerry and Bush, which was very close. 2008 was a big election, a lot of big turnout. 2010, the gubernatorial race in Iowa was considered very competitive, very salient election. And yet you see fairly consistent numbers across the board. So not much is changing yet in Sioux County.
And Bruce or Wayne, would you care to weigh in here?
I think one thing we can look at in terms of Sioux County is the impact of Northwestern College, which is not a huge college, but it's not a huge county. And the ability of that college to project its culture across the county. As a conservative Christian college, those tend to be the core voters in the Republican Party anymore, even more so than, say, upper-class or upper-middle-class business. So that would be one where we're not really talking immigration or maybe any of the main issues that affected the election of 2012, but a particular demographic which is more conservative than most of the U.S. population.
And looking at Johnson County, jokingly, people will refer to it as the People's Republic of Johnson County because it's so blue. But it seems it's not as blue as Sioux is red. Are Democratic voters more likely to cross party lines? I mean, I don't know if you can really make the comparison just on two counties alone, but what are your thoughts on that?
This is Wayne Moyer. My guess is that there's more people in between in Johnson County that are not either strong Republicans or strong Democrats. And there was also, I think, a special when you go back to Jim Leach was congressman. He was a very, very moderate Republican and attracted a good deal of Democratic support as well as Republican support. So I think my guess would be that you have a lot of people who are moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans more in Johnson County, and a moderate Republican candidate can do better.
Chris Lehrman, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, just to back up what Wayne was saying, you know, if you look at Sioux County, the no party folks are about a third of what the Republicans are in terms of party ID. But in Johnson County, the no party folks are about double what the number of Republican voters are and just under what Democratic voters are. So you see a significantly higher percentage of folks who identify as no party in Johnson County compared to Sioux County. So if you have a moderate Republican like Jim Leach, then you start to see some differences.
I want to reach out to one of our callers. Kent in Muscatine has a question for us. Kent, what's your question?
Well, and I think they anticipated the question, which was you've got the 80-20 split in the red county, and what percentage have no party affiliation? Because, you know, you don't get electoral votes by counties. You're looking at an overall, and what effect is living in a predominantly red or blue county have on those with no party affiliation?
Okay. What would you say to that, Bruce?
Well, I think the way the Electoral College is constructed, a vote counts more if your state is competitive. So it doesn't really matter if your county is competitive. Democratic vote in Sioux County, there were, it looks like, 2,700 of them for Obama in 2012. You know, those count towards his overall total and weigh in the balance as Iowa determines its electoral vote. So different than voting in a heavily red or heavily blue state when your vote really doesn't matter much toward the electoral count.
And what would happen, you know, there's a lot of people arguing that we should be electing a president based on the national popular vote. What would that do to a state like Iowa where we see more red counties than those that are blue?
This is Wayne Moyer here. I think Iowa would get one heck of a lot less attention if we were to go to a popular vote, because overall, in terms of the national picture, we have a very, very small percentage of the electorate. And so for small states like Iowa, small population states like Iowa, it's a real advantage in terms of influence to have the Electoral College.
Let me ask my fellow panelists this. I have always been cautious about changing the Electoral College, simply partly because of unforeseen consequences, and also because I've thought it had a moderating effect on overall voting counts. But this year it seemed to have an unusually distorting effect in terms of where the candidates campaigned, that they were so focused both in their advertising dollars and their appearances on a small number of states, happily including Iowa from my perspective. So I was at times ready to think that the Electoral College has become so distorting that that we might get rid of it.
This is Wayne Moyer again. I guess my concern is that some states have become so solidly blue and so solidly red that there really isn't very much debate in those states, and I'm not sure that doing away with the Electoral College would change that. My suspicion is that there's a bunch of other things other than the Electoral College which is causing this problem. A lot of it, I think, is Iowa has a very good process for selecting or for sizing up congressional districts that keeps it away from politics. And so many congressional districts around the country have been gerrymandered in such a way is that they are solidly Democratic or solidly Republican, and there really isn't very much competition.
I was just going to say, do we know whether voting behavior is influenced by the makeup of the county, first of all? I mean, in other words, if all your neighbors are voting Republican, are you more likely to vote Republican?
Well, there's certainly an argument that there's somewhat of a tendency to self-select in terms of who you associate with. And so it may not necessarily be your neighbors, but, you know, the people you talk to, you're going to talk to people that you agree with. And in some cases, you know, if you see your neighbor, you know, has a yard sign for a Democratic candidate, you may be more likely to at least consider a Democratic candidate or talk to them. But if you disagree with them, you're not going to talk to them either way. And so it's kind of a yes and no answer on that.
And go ahead.
I was going to say, and to go back to Wayne's point, I think he hit the nail on the head as far as the Electoral College is concerned. Mm-hmm. I think it does get down to redistricting. And the way Iowa does it, presumably that will keep Iowa somewhat competitive if it really truly is a nonpartisan process, whereas these other states, it's drawn by elected officials who keep trying to keep their job. And so I think that if you're going to try to adjust, you know, the Electoral College or try to adjust to take into consideration the popular vote, I think it has to start back with the redistricting process and having more states move toward a system like Iowa's.
And I did a quick check of census data. Between 2000 and 2010, Iowa increased its population only by 4.1%. Surrounding states like Nebraska went up 6.7%, Missouri 7%, Minnesota was close to 8%. We might be redistricting again in a few years. What would that potentially do if we saw, you know, Steve King as an incumbent having to battle for a district that's more across northern Iowa?
Well, I think he's already doing that. I mean, certainly after the 2010 redistricting, his district completely changed in terms of, you know, being the western third of the state to now being kind of the western and northwestern part of the state, coming all the way over to bordering Black Hawk County. So if we get to 2020 and Iowa loses somehow would lose another congressional seat, you know, I'm not sure how they would draw it up. You may have a sort of a massive western to northwestern district, and then the other two districts would be divided between kind of a diagonal line going from Des Moines up through Decorah or Allamaquis County.
And the president won fewer than 40 counties in Iowa. These dark red counties can't really, which are mostly rural, can't really overcome the dark blue counties like Johnson and Clinton, surprisingly, which is a fairly rural county in itself. But, I mean, are we going to start seeing less and less rural issues being a part of the campaign talk? I mean, Mitt Romney was on a farm in Van Meter once. I was trying to think back if the president made any farm stops. But are rural issues going to be at the heart of any presidential campaigns as population continues to lose or to decline in those counties?
My sense, Wayne Moyer, again, that farms are getting bigger and bigger. Rural populations are getting smaller and smaller. Cities are getting bigger and bigger. So I think what's going on in Iowa is typical of the rest of the country. The urban vote is going to become more important.
I don't have the sense that people in the rural counties in Iowa are being addressed on rural issues or are being motivated by rural issues. I get the impression that it's more things like taxes and cultural issues.
So bottom line, can we tell from the data what makes a county red or blue, or is there some way to predict?
I'm not sure if we can tell what makes them red or blue. I think what we can tell from the data is how reliable and consistent they are in terms of being red or blue. So, you know, from a campaign perspective, you can look at the data and figure out, okay, what can we expect? What type of candidate do we have? How strong are they? And that's going to be some indication of how much you can kind of move the vote at the margins.
Go ahead. I heard somebody jumping in there.
That was me breathing. I think you can identify certain demographic groups that are either heavily Republican or heavily Democratic and look for concentrations of those. So in counties that are heavily Black, those are probably going to be heavily Democratic. Counties that have a high percentage of people of no religious affiliation, likely to be heavily Democratic. People who are white evangelical Christian, probably heavily Republican.
Is it any different in Iowa than anywhere else?
I don't get the sense that it is. We see the counties that are out west that don't tend to be more rural, a little bit older population. Those tend to be the ones that are more likely to vote Republican. It takes a big election like 2008 where you see Obama pick up a few rural counties such as Carroll or Crawford County that a Democratic candidate normally wouldn't compete in. But for the most part, I think what happens in Iowa certainly mirrors what's happening in the rest of the country.
And do you have any interest, Chris, now that we've kind of pushed you in this way? Are you going to start looking at all the other counties too?
I would really like to. I teach an Iowa politics class in the spring, and this is starting to sound like a really good idea for students to help me out with in terms of, you know, if I have 30 students in there, maybe each one could take a county and we could, by the end of the semester, get pretty close to having all 99.
All right. My guests are Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa, Wayne Moyer from Grinnell College, and Bruce Nesmith from Coe College. We're talking politics today, and you can join in on the conversation. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll talk about the issues that are facing in politics, and also maybe we'll talk a little bit more about this red and blue county here in Iowa. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. My guests from the first part of the show are sticking around. Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa, Wayne Moyer from Grinnell College, and Bruce Nesmith from Coe College. Thanks, guys, for sticking around for the second part of the show. We'll transition now to the week in politics. And first, I kind of want to back up. Maybe I'm a little bit biased because I'm a reporter, but you know, we've been sitting around, not sitting around, but we've been joking about election fatigue kind of sitting in, constantly running around the state, you know, as Mitt Romney and the president are making stops. And now it's like this fog has lifted, and the issues that are at the center of the national dialogue are the fiscal cliff, what's going on in Israel, and the Benghazi tragedy. Bruce Nesmith from Coe College, did the national dialogue during the election prevent some kind of bigger picture dialogue about these issues?
I think it did, and I think there are reasons why both candidates tended to shy away from issues and also tended to shy away from discussions of their own qualifications. For Romney, a lot of his own background and was controversial among his base, and or at least among the Republican base. And for Obama, his handling of issues, while I think has been mostly sound, hasn't brought totally delightful outcomes. And so he would be on the defensive there. So both tended to be. Put a lot of emphasis on personal attacks on the other side, and so issues of economics and taxation and the budget and foreign policy tended to be discussed in cartoon bubbles, if at all.
Wayne Moyer from Grinnell, what are your thoughts?
Let me just add a little bit to what Bruce has said. Certainly in terms of foreign policy, it was very hard to see what the differences between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama really were. They both wanted to get out of Afghanistan, for instance. Neither of them wanted to intervene in Syria, for instance. And so the similarities of their views, I think neither saw very much mileage to make foreign policy a major campaign issue. And then in terms of domestic issues, the fiscal cliff, for instance, neither Congress is going to have to break that and come up with a solution. And I'm not sure that either of them has a sort of a magic way of coming to grips with that. I mean, Romney could say, well, I got along very well with Democrats in Massachusetts, and therefore I'll be able to get along with Democrats in Washington. On the other hand, he's untested in Washington. So I think both are very cautious for that reason, that they didn't really have anything that could really be persuasive.
Well, the president was criticized in his first term for not paying attention to Israel and the Middle East peace process, and now it's very much erupting. Well, what are the implications for the president as he starts his second term with this, implications for the country? Why do we care? Wayne, what would you say to that?
Well, the problem is that the festering situation in the Middle East has antagonized a great number of Muslim people in that area of the world. And that has a couple of problems. One, more and more isolates Israel. It strengthens the influence, I think, of Iran in the area. And the inability of the president to make any progress in terms of a Middle East peace settlement, sort of strengthens the anti-American forces in the area and makes it more difficult for the United States.
Well, should the United States be involved in this? What would you say to that, Chris Larimer from the University of Northern Iowa?
Well, you know, this is a little bit out of my area of expertise, but mm-hmm. I maybe try to throw this back to Wayne a little bit. But I wonder as we get a number of years down the road from the Obama presidency, if his presidency is really going to be viewed as more of a foreign policy presidency, in that, you know, he's had to deal with Syria, he's had to deal with Libya, he's had to deal now with the Middle East, and certainly we've had festering issues with Iran. There have been nice and some not very nice talks with, you know, Russia, China, North Korea. And so I wonder if, you know, for all the talk about Obama coming into office in 2008, trying to change the nature of domestic politics, we had, healthcare legislation passed in 2010. I wonder if this is going to be increasingly a foreign policy presidency.
You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. We're talking about the week in politics. If you'd like to jump in, our number is 866-780-9100, or you can ask us a question or the panel of political scientists on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Wayne, I'm sorry, I started to cut you off. What were you going to say there?
Well, the president has far more powers in foreign policy than he has in domestic policy. And Obama is facing gridlock on most domestic issues. I mean, I suspect he's going to get over the fiscal cliff problem because I suspect the pressures from the markets, et cetera, are going to put pressures on both Republicans and Democrats to reach a solution. But I'm not sure Obama's going to be able, given that the House is Republican and the Senate is Democrat, to get much other domestic legislation through. And so his opportunities to do things, as well as his challenges, I think are going to be mostly in foreign policy.
Now, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrived in Israel yesterday to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and is in Cairo today to try and help broker a ceasefire to end violence in Gaza. Negotiations have likely been complicated by increasing violence, including a bus bombing in Tel Aviv today. At a news conference, Secretary Clinton reiterated President Obama's unwavering commitment to Israel. Here's what was said.
President Obama asked me to come to Israel with a very clear message. America's commitment to Israel's security is rock solid and unwavering. That is why we believe it is essential to de-escalate the situation in Gaza. The rocket attacks from terrorist organizations inside Gaza on Israeli cities and towns must end and a broader calm restored. The goal must be a durable outcome that promotes regional stability and advances the security and legitimate aspirations of Israelis and Palestinians alike.
So does sending Secretary Clinton to the Middle East signal a change in how the Obama administration sees its role in the region, Wayne?
I don't think so. Okay. Just before your program came on the air, there was an announcement that there has been a ceasefire in the Gaza strip situation. And I think that if, in fact, that is accurate, I think that is Hillary Clinton gets some credit for that. And I think then the visit is a success. The United States doesn't want another Israeli invasion of Gaza. That was devastating, I think, for both for Israel and in a sense of United States prestige in the Middle East. And if we prevented that from happening again, I think that would, and we have achieved a ceasefire, I think that's a great success.
So how do things change if Hillary Clinton doesn't stay on as the Secretary of State?
That depends on who her successor is, and there's a big fight. I'm not sure fight is the right word, but Obama seems to want to appoint Susan Rice, who's the current ambassador to the United Nations, but there's very substantial Republican opposition in the Senate. From people like John McCain, who I suspect would like to see John Kerry appointed Secretary of State. But my sense is whoever is Secretary of State, the U.S. interests are pretty fixed in the Middle East.
Staying on the topic of international news, this week President Barack Obama became the first sitting U.S. president to visit both Burma and Cambodia. While in Burma, Obama expressed support for the country's first steps towards democracy while promoting an end to violence in the western state where fighting between ethnic Buddhists and Muslims has caused thousands to be displaced and hundreds of fatalities.
There's no excuse for violence against innocent people. And the Rohingya hold within themselves the same dignity as you do and I do. National reconciliation will take time, but for the sake of our common humanity and for the sake of this country's future, it's necessary to stop incitement and to stop violence. And I welcome the government's commitment to address the issues of injustice and accountability and humanitarian access and citizenship. That's a vision that the world will support as you move forward.
So what is the significance of this trip? And as far as a strategy goes, why is this an area important to the U.S.?
Wayne Moyer again. I think the United States sees its economic future very closely linked with trade, even more than it is now trade with Asia. That's very, very central to us. The other thing is we're concerned about the expansion of Chinese influence throughout Southeast Asia, and very concerned about Chinese efforts to try to control the sea lanes, very strategic sea lanes between the Philippines and Vietnam, for instance. And we're also concerned about big disputes over small islands in the South Pacific that have a lot of oil that China is claiming, but other countries are claiming too, and future violence preventing that. So the U.S. has got a lot at stake, as well as democratization in Burma and what trying to encourage that process. So there's a lot of things going on there.
Chris or Bruce, do you care to weigh in on this?
Well, I think you got the right issues in the right order. I think that it's a kind of dicey game to play with human rights because Burma is clearly far from where we would want them to be, yet they're in much better than they were even 2 or 3 years ago. So how do you act in a way that is encouraging and rewarding without discouraging further improvement?
Chris Larimer?
No, I think I would echo that as well. I think it's just a very delicate, this is a very delicate first step in what is obviously going to be a very long process in trying to establish some sort of normal relationship with East Asia.
We're going to bring it back to Iowa. We have a caller, Payne in Creston, I believe, has a question about something that the governor said recently. Payne?
Yes, good afternoon. Happy to hear you. I'm heading home to Iowa for the holidays, so of course I got to turn on public radio.
Good to hear.
I attend Ball State University, and there I am a board operator for Indiana Public Radio. So I just thought I'd mention that.
Got to get the plug in. Yeah.
Yes, I'm one of you. my question is, I just heard when I was coming back some news here in Iowa that Branstad has called for the end of the straw poll, and I attended the last one to kind of understand what it was about and see how it worked. And really, it serves as kind of a pep rally for the Republican Party. And he said Michelle Bachmann's success there and failure later on in the year is exhibit A, quote, for why they should get rid of it. And I mean, I understand what he's saying, but Michelle Bachmann had several comments after the straw poll, and I do believe her comments about God sending storms and Katrina as punishment came after the straw poll. So I don't know. I think when the Republicans have lost the presidential election in Iowa for several years, almost becoming a blue state, that maybe getting rid of something Republicans look forward to is not a good idea. Just wanted your opinion on that.
Yeah, the significance of the Iowa straw poll. Chris, what do you have to say to that?
Well, I think it's a really good question. I should say Professor Donna Hoffman in our department and I have done a little bit of research, just some survey research on people who attend the straw poll. And, you know, Payne is absolutely right that this is, this is a party event and it's supposed to be an early test of organizational strength for campaigns. But, you know, increasingly there are questions about the relevance. You know, Michelle Bachmann was the first straw poll winner to not finish in the top three on caucus night. So, you know, we didn't have Mitt Romney participating in the straw poll. So there are always questions about, you know, how relevant is it? On the other hand, you can look at it and say, well, Tim Pawlenty competed in the straw poll, finished, what he considered to be a disappointing third place and dropped out, you know, and then there was always speculation about whether or not he should have stayed in. But you're talking about an event in August prior to the election year in which the winner of the event, in this case, receives about 4,300 votes. I think there are always questions about the relevance of a party event like that, particularly when you think about how people attend the event. For the most part, you know, well over probably 3/4 of the people attending the straw poll are getting tickets from individual campaigns. So it's just a recruitment effort for campaigns to try to establish some ground and some organization in the state.
Well, and it's always so early on in the election mm-hmm. process, it's almost like voters are just thirsty for some kind of a prediction, but that's not really the purpose that it serves. Would you say that's an accurate portrayal?
Yeah. I'm not sure it is a very good prediction. And certainly you can look back over time at the trends. Usually if you do well in the straw poll, you're going to do well in the caucus. But this last year, certainly that was not the case with Michelle Bachmann and then, you know, Mitt Romney not competing really. or at all. And so I think there are going to that's a legitimate question going forward. If it's, you know, it tends to be dominated by party activists. At least in the research with Donna Hoffman, you know, we found out that there are some differences in terms of the people who attend the straw poll compared to Republicans statewide. We found that those folks that attend the straw poll were slightly, you know, more sympathetic toward the Tea Party. They were also slightly more religious than Republicans statewide. So if you're, you know, if there's a concern about is the straw poll representing Republicans all across the state, then I think that's a legitimate question.
If you go back to 2008, this is Bruce Nesmith. If you go back to 2008, not quite as stark a result, but Mitt Romney won the straw poll and then his campaign imploded. And Sam Brownback dropped out as a result of the straw poll. So the cost of the straw poll, other than you know, whatever people are shelling out to get in there, the cost of the straw poll is that you're losing candidates who may have some values if they stick around. And you're also rewarding the candidates who win, which raises the possibility that in 2016 it won't be taken seriously. And I think that may be where the governor is going.
And Wayne, do you think it will be taken seriously?
Well, I'm impressed with the arguments that we've just heard, and I think it won't be taken seriously. I think there's a good chance that we will do away with it.
We go to an email that we have from Nick in Iowa City. He writes, with two-party domination of politics and third-party hostility, the opportunity for public education and discussion of issues are substantially curtailed. As he says, we've just seen, third parties have been the source of many of America's political innovations. The problem has been the so-called spoiler factor. Voting for a third-party candidate may cause the major party candidate you least like to end up getting elected. Instant runoff voting enables voters to vote first from the heart and second from the head. He's wondering if the guests would be willing to advocate for instant runoff voting in Iowa to provide Iowans these advantages and a much more nuanced political discussion, as well as more indication of what Iowans really prefer and believe following an election. Quite a short story of an email. That's good. What would you guys say to that?
Bruce Nesmith, I'd say yes. If it could be satisfactorily explained to the voters, I think it's a possibility. Instant runoff or approval voting have a much better possibility of being representative of voters' true sentiments. And I think multiple candidates. I think the best presidential campaign in terms of discussion that I can remember is 1992, when Perot could be silly. But I think his presence in the race helped do that. The problem is if it's confusing to voters, then things go haywire.
Chris, would you care to weigh in there?
I agree. I think the way it's presented to voters is going to be key in terms of understanding how it is, how the process works, and that's going to change, you know, the strategies for campaigns. And so, I think it would be an interesting step, but I think it's a big step for Iowa to take at this point.
There were some legislative leadership announcements this week. Many minds are aligning now to the upcoming session. What should voters, what should Iowans expect moving forward into the here at the state level? Bruce Nesmith, any thoughts there?
I would think not very much, just because in contrast with the national level, these are the last 2 years of the governor's term, and so as is the case with the last couple of years of a president's term, a lot of the time is spent looking forward to the next election. I will say that it's interesting that there was not a wholesale shift, particularly in the Republican Party, which suggests that they're going to be cautious about any new direction that people might want to take the party in.
Chris Larimer, that expertise of yours, what do you think about that?
As far as the session, you know, I'm not sure if we'll see a lot different. I think this is going to be, you know, as Bruce was saying, the governor, his second penultimate session essentially to push through that signature policy achievement that he's going to want, whether he's running in 2014 or if he's, you know, paving the way for someone else, perhaps the lieutenant governor, whatever it might be. But it's going to be about getting commercial property tax reform. I don't think there's any question there. You know, I don't see social issues coming up. I think that that ship has sailed in terms of talking about abortion or gay marriage, certainly with the retention election in Iowa. I think that's done. So I think it is going to come down to commercial property taxes, you know, whether it's personal income tax cut as another issue or creating jobs. I think that's probably going to be the primary focus of this legislative session. I would be surprised if we saw another session that gets extended into the summer that we like we did a couple of years ago.
Wayne, would you care to weigh in?
I agree with both Bruce and Chris. I think the fact that the Senate is still Democrat and the House is still Republican and the governor is still Republican is we're going to get pretty much the same as we have in the last 2 years.
So the status quo moving forward will be the same arguments that we've heard again and again?
That's my sense. An incremental change at best.
Sounds like we all agree, and that's where we will end our conversation. Thank you to my guests, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, to Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College, and Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
You too.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese, Tony Daner, and John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available at iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program, river to river@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.